Well, I'm excited because, I read a lot of books and I have different people come on the show, and sometimes I like their book. Sometimes I'm not that excited about it, but I'm respectful. Well, this one, I just read this book and I'm very excited about it. So I'm hoping we can dig a bit into it during the program. And I'm going to bring my guest on right now. Her name is Karen Dina, and she's a chiropractic doctor who has been studying and practicing raw food nutrition for over 25 years. Karen has studied naturopathic medicine at Bastyr University and graduated from Palmer College of Chiropractic West and has an honors degree in biology. She and her husband, Rick Dinas, are co-developers and instructors of the series of Science of Raw Food Nutrition classes taught at Living Light Culinary Institute in Fort Bragg, California. They have an international consulting and lab work analysis practice and are dedicated to teaching a functional and scientifically sound approach to raw plant-based diets. Karen, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thanks so much for having me, Karen.
Yeah, so I'm glad you could come on a little earlier than planned. That's because I just finished reading this book, and I thought there's so many wonderful things to touch on. That I wanted to talk to you for a long time.
Great.
Yeah. So, as I was telling you earlier, I really love this book. And number one, I think what I really like about it is that you're taking a very calm, scientific approach to food, and you're explaining things so clearly, so simply. Not everyone can do that. And you did an excellent job.
Thank you very much. It's
Yeah.
something that I really enjoy doing. Both my husband and I really like to take complex pieces of information and make them relatable to the average person.
Yeah, I like to do that too for food and for some other technical things. So I really appreciate when other people do a really good job about it. Now, so let's talk about the raw food diet. I talk about it from time to time. I was actually on an all raw diet maybe 10 years ago for a couple of years. It's just like all things related to food. There's a lot of information out on the internet. It's overwhelming. It's confusing. And I think you've taken a very nice, objective, clear approach. But let's just talk about what is a raw food diet
Okay.
briefly.
So when I think of a raw food diet, I think of a diet that focuses on whole natural plant foods in their raw form. And that can be composed of a variety of different foods. I would say that for the most part, fruits and vegetables would form the basis of a raw food diet with nuts and seeds and other types of raw foods added in, depending on what type of mix people would like to have in their diet.
Raw food, we know it is really important. Plant foods are really important. I think we're going to learn more in the future about the benefits of raw food, maybe in ways that we don't even know how to measure or explain. Some people have some mystical terms for it that make scientists like roll their eyes. But I think, and I think you know what I mean.
Yes, I absolutely do.
but like many other things, we know things without being able to explain them scientifically, and at some point science will catch up, and then we'll be able to explain some things more logically so that they'll be more accepted. But in the meantime, there's kind of a romance, I think, with the raw food diet and similarly with the paleo diet, where
Right.
people, those who are attracted to it, want to do what's natural, what nature intended for us all along on this planet, and
Right.
going back to these kinds of diets seems to have a romantic feeling about it.
I think you're probably right. I think that a lot of people, especially people who attend our classes, are really looking to kind of get back to our roots as far as what diet would be best for us and what best supports our health. And so I think that there's been a shift really in the past 25 years since I've gotten into this, I've become more aware of this shift. I would say when I got started back in 1990, there was less of an awareness of food and how food affects our body, how it affects our health. And there's much more of a consciousness about that now.
Okay, so one of the first things I know is, well, you go in and explain macronutrients. You've got a great chapter on carbohydrates and fiber, a great chapter on protein. Where do you get your protein? And
the
fat.
Biggest question of all.
The biggest question of all. And I may jump around here a bit, but since I mentioned protein, I love what you did with showing amino acids, the essential amino acids, what we need and how we can get it from so many different plant-based foods and how easy that is. So just briefly, tell us what essential amino acids are.
Well, essential amino acids are the amino acids that our body needs in order to build protein-based structures in our body. Now, some of the amino acids that we find in nature are not essential. In other words, our body can make those from the amino acids that we take in. But of the 22 or 23 that are recognized in nature, about 9 or 10 of them are considered to be essential, and those are the ones that our body cannot make. And so those are the ones that we tend to focus on in this book, showing people how a mixture of whole natural plant foods in their raw form can provide us with the amino acids that we do need.
Now, there have been some terms, and I don't even try and use them anymore because I know lots of people have different interpretations of what they are, complete and incomplete proteins. But basically, okay. The thought behind it was that animal protein was complete and plant proteins were not, because the plant proteins didn't have either enough or all of the essential amino acids that we need as building blocks to make the proteins that we need. It's really been some bad press. And what I loved about the charts that you showed, now clearly we're not going to eat 2,500 calories of one food, but no. I understand what you were doing behind the chart, showing that all of these different foods that are plant foods have enough individually, and then, of course, when we have a nice varied diet together, to make the essential amino acids that we need to get the building blocks together to make the proteins we need, and we easily meet all the requirements. No brainer.
That's absolutely true, and it's nice when things are a no brainer like that, so we don't have to, you know, get out our calculator to try to figure out what we're getting. And I think that the whole idea of complete and non-complete proteins is kind of based in the early 1900s in the work of Osborne and Mendel, when they were trying to figure out what complement of protein rats would need. And so scientists kind of extrapolated that rat information to humans, and it wasn't until the work of Dr. Rose that came along decades later that showed that from a human standpoint, we have a different need for essential amino acids than the rats did. And so the idea of incomplete proteins is actually based in this early research in the early 1900s, whereas the information that we learned from Dr. Rose decades later showed that we can get plenty of the amino acids that we need from whole natural plant foods without having to use a calculator.
Yes, and that just is a reminder that all of the research that we're doing on non-human animals, including mice and rats, doesn't always give us good information for human animals.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we treat them horribly in the process, which I don't think is the way to go at all.
I agree with you completely.
Yeah, so, okay, so we can get our protein really easily and deliciously. And then you had some very good tables talking about glycemic index. And this is really an interesting topic. So one of the things we do in science. Dr. T. Colin Campbell talks about it a lot, and he calls it reductionism, where we focus on one thing, one nutrient, and talk about that. But what we all have to keep in mind is that we're an integrated body, and everything kind of works together as a symphony. But still, in order to understand, we break things down into different parameters, different nutrients. And one of them is the glycemic index, which I think has been pretty helpful in understanding what goes on in our bodies.
Definitely.
Can you talk a little bit about the glycemic index?
Yeah, the glycemic index is a measure of the effect of the carbohydrates in our diet on our blood sugar. And so individual foods that are rich in carbohydrates are going to have this glycemic index number that is a measure of that effect. And so what we observe is that foods that tend to be higher in, for example, glucose, tend to be higher on the glycemic index than other carbohydrates that tend to be lower on the glycemic index, like, for example, fructose. Fructose is low on the glycemic index, glucose is higher. Now, oftentimes people tend to think that fruits, for example, are high glycemic because they're so rich in carbohydrate. But if we look at the actual carbohydrate mix within individual fruits, we find that most fruits are actually low glycemic, which is oftentimes counterintuitive for some people. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the numbers, you know, like I have a couple of charts here that actually lay out the glycemic index of a variety of different foods, and it shows on here that most of the fruits are actually low on the glycemic index.
Which, when people are pre-diabetic or have diabetes and they're looking for ways to get healthy, they're often instructed to stay away from fruit.
Oftentimes, and I think that that's just, it's just like a perception that I think just propagates itself. And it's not necessarily based in true science, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book and put this information in here to really clarify this information for people so that they don't have to be afraid of healthy carbohydrate-containing foods like fruits.
Okay, now one of the things that I love is your very non-judgmental, very objective about all the different possibilities or the different ways that people can eat. You're not saying that we absolutely have to eat 100% raw. You're open to a number of different configurations that seem to sit well with different individuals. And while we're talking about the glycemic index, you have some tables where you're comparing the whole grain, for example, with a more processed version of that grain. And this kind of highlights the importance of eating whole foods versus anything that's processed more or less.
Absolutely. That's one of, I think, the underlying themes of this book is focusing on whole natural plant foods, because not only are they better in this instance for glycemic control, they're also a much better source of usable nutrients, and, you know, they're just better overall for our health for so many different reasons that I talk about in the book. So that is an excellent point to bring up.
Okay, so I talk to a lot of people about food, and I get all kinds of interesting questions. And often I find people are looking for a way to have the foods that they have learned to love that aren't necessarily good for them, but maybe there's a way to have them where they're not so bad. So an example is white bread versus whole wheat bread, thinking that whole wheat bread is going to be better than white bread. And then now there's sprouted grains, and you talk a bit about sprouting grains, and I want to get into that in a minute, but I just want to talk about this one example where you can have a sprouted wheat, for example, and then what happens if you take a sprouted wheat and mill it into flour and make bread? Is that okay?
Sprouted wheat. So if you take sprouted wheat and turn it into a flour, well, it's still a whole food. Unless you have removed some of the, you know, some of the ingredients in there, unless you remove some of the nutrients, it's still going to be a whole food. From a glycemic standpoint, for example, it might be a little higher on the glycemic index because the milling process, you know, might very well make those carbohydrates more available to the body, so it may cause them to be a little higher glycemic. It's still, for the most part, it could still be considered a whole food.
Good, that's good to know. All right, let's talk about grains for a moment, the good, the bad about grains. So what's your take on grains?
You know, I've actually been thinking about grains for a long time, and I've been doing some research specifically on gluten because there's a bit of a controversy these days about non-gluten-containing grains. And I actually did a teleconference about these kind of controversial grains a couple of weeks ago. And for the most part, what I'm finding is that even some of the non-gluten-containing grains do have proteins in them that can resemble gluten. And so some people who have gluten sensitivities or gluten intolerance, like celiac, may actually have reactions to these so-called non-gluten-containing grains. And so
I've heard that with oatmeal. Are there other grains like that?
Yeah, oats is one of the big ones because there's a protein in oats called avenin that actually does resemble true gluten. And corn is another one, too. Corn has a protein in it called zein, and that's spelled Z-E-I-N. And that also looks like true gluten. And so some people with gluten sensitivities have had trouble with corn, even though corn is classified as a gluten-free grain.
Okay, so there's a possibility that people have digestive issues with a variety of different grains, but people like their grains. So should we include grains in our diet or not?
You know, I think that's a personal judgment call. You know, if you're somebody who doesn't have a gluten-related health challenge and things like rice don't really affect you, then I don't see the problem with having them. In fact, I eat brown rice. I also like the so-called pseudo-grains, which are not members of the grain family. So they're non-gluten containing, but sometimes they're called pseudo-grains because they resemble grains. And examples of that would be quinoa and amaranth. Buckwheat would also fall into that classification as well. And so for people who might have gluten sensitivities, those so-called pseudo-grains can potentially be a viable option for them.
Okay, well, a lot of people love grains, and they can be more convenient sometimes to help us feel satisfied.
Yeah, they can be convenient, and they're also really nutrient dense. And, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't have a problem with them, they can be an excellent addition to your diet. And the same is true for legumes. Now, sometimes legumes get a bad reputation for a variety of reasons, but, you know, I like my lentils. I like them sprouted, and I like them steamed, and I like them whole as well. It's just, I think that whether or not we decide to have these things in our diet really depends on how they work for us individually. You know, what type of results we get from them. Do they allow us to enjoy a whole food plant-based diet and get the most out of ourselves health-wise?
I love my lentils too, and I love beans, all kinds of beans. Now, you have one chart here, I think, when you were showing the different amino acids, where you include soybeans, but you didn't really talk about soybeans in the rest of the book. Do you have any feelings about soy? Because it's quite a controversial food.
You know, soy is a huge controversy, and I actually devote quite a bit of time to soy in our Science of Raw Food Nutrition series because so many people ask about it. And from what I've seen, the reason why soy tends to be so controversial is because we see that in certain populations in the world, such as Asian populations, we see that consuming soy supposedly or is thought to be protective against certain types of health challenges. But we don't see that same protection in Western society for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons why we think we see this kind of disconnect is because in Western society, people tend to have a higher body mass index. They tend to carry a little bit more fat than in general certain Asian populations. And estrogen, for example, is mm-hmm. made by a variety of different organs in the body, mostly in women in ovaries, for example. And what also produces estrogen in the body is fat tissue. And the more fat tissue that we have, the more estrogen we produce. Mm-hmm. Now, when we consume soy, we are getting phytoestrogens or plant estrogens. And when we add soy to a diet and we have already have plenty of body fat that's already producing a lot of estrogen, we're kind of adding more estrogen on top of a lot of estrogen to begin with. And so any type of health challenge that might be associated with excess or with greater amounts of estrogen might be potentially aggravated by soy. And that's one of the reasons why it's so controversial. There's kind of that thought. So the consumption of soy in certain populations might be protective, whereas we don't see that same level of protection in Western society.
Well, that's just another example of looking at one thing, this reductionist concept, because all the nutrients work together in harmony. And if we have more fat in the diet or more fat in our bodies, maybe we will process nutrients differently than if we're leaner with less fat.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Absolutely. It's very true.
Yeah. Okay, so there are a couple of big things I wanted to really highlight, and one of them is this essential fatty acid story, and you really did a great job of talking about it and making it very understandable, and I thought we might talk a little bit about it because it's a relatively new subject, and I still don't think we've figured it all out yet, but... Let's talk about omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids and getting them in balance.
Okay. Well, as far as omega-6s and omega-3s go, we want to try to achieve a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 of about 4 to 1. Now, there are some researchers that think maybe 5 to 1 would be fine. Even some researchers say about 10 to 1. But if we look at people in Western populations, we oftentimes see 20 to 1. In other words, people in Western populations tend to be getting a lot more omega-6s than omega-3s. Now, if we have a more favorable ratio, which, for example, I said 4 to 1 would be a good example of that, what that means is that there's more of an opportunity for the omega-3s that we take into our body to convert into the omega-3s that are thought to be so beneficial for us, like DHA and EPA. Because in whole natural plant food-based diets, we don't necessarily get DHA and EPA. We get it mostly in the form of alpha-linolenic acid, also known as ALA. And conversion from ALA into DHA and EPA is difficult when we have a lot more omega-6s than omega-3s. But if we have a better ratio than that, conversion of alpha-linolenic acid into DHA and EPA is more optimized.
And we're discovering that there's a lot of health issues related to not having sufficient DHA and EPA. So it's really important either to make them or to find a source to consume them.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why you hear physicians saying that we should consume fish oil, because fish oil is DHA, or it's mostly DHA. But there are definitely vegetarian, vegan options to fish oil. In fact, there's a certain type of algae that produces DHA that lives in cold water, and this algae forms the basis of the cold water food chain. And it's not fish that make DHA. It's actually the algae. So the fish come along and they eat the algae, and that's where they get their DHA from. So kind of the argument that I make in this book is that if you're going to eat DHA, or if you want preformed DHA, find an algae-based form of it. Go right to the source instead of running that DHA through a fish. It just makes sense to kind of go to the source. And so yeah. I talk a little bit about that.
I'm just trying to keep track of these recommended ratios. As you said, there are different people recommending different ratios. In fact, I've even heard like Dr. T. Callan Campbell and his camp recommending 1-to-1 omega-6 fatty acids to omega-3 fatty acids. And that's really hard to do.
I know. I was going to say, that's pretty challenging. In order to do that on a raw food diet, for example, you'd have to eat almost exclusively like fruits and vegetables with a lot of leafy greens. That's a tall order. That would be pretty intense. My thought is that you'd have to be supplementing, or you could, you know, just add, or I guess another way you can achieve that is by adding a lot of chia seeds or flax or something like that that's super high in omega-3.
Yeah, so it makes it, to me, it seems like maybe the 1-to-1 isn't the right ratio, because I really don't think healthy, nutritious eating should be that difficult. And if you're eating healthy, unprocessed whole foods and still struggling to get the right ratio, it makes it hard to believe that's the right ratio.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why what my husband and I teach in class is we say, you know, what's achievable and what will give you the results that you want, or what can potentially lead to that. And about a 4-to-1 ratio is totally achievable without having to stress about it. And on a whole food plant-based raw diet, if you're eating fruits and vegetables and some nuts and seeds, and you add some chia seeds to your dressing at night, you're about 4-to-1, and it works out pretty well. And that's just one example. On a cooked food vegan diet, you could do something similar to that, you know, by adding steamed vegetables and, you know, adding some chia seeds to whatever recipes that you choose.
One of the things I like is you include a lot of numbers in this book, and that's really important to make a point and to make people feel confident that when they choose whole plant foods, they're going to be getting everything that they need, because of decades of people saying, no, you can't. And you show that we clearly can, above and beyond, get the nutrition that we need. Personally, I don't suggest that people count anything, count calories, count grams. It's not fun. It's stressful, like you mentioned, and that's not healthy.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Kind of my point with putting all these numbers in here is because I don't want people to worry about it, but I want them to know, you know, how to structure a healthy raw plant-based diet so they don't have to worry about it. I kind of did like all the legwork for them. And for me myself, I don't really count anything, mm-hmm. because, you know, years ago I kind of put information like this together and sort of got an idea of what nutrients I needed and what foods were good sources of that. And so I sort of naturally gravitate to those foods. So I don't think about calories. I don't think about zinc or iron or calcium. I just know that the mixture of foods that I'm getting that are rich in these foods is going to give me what I need. But I guess the point of having all these charts in this book was to sort of reassure people that this is achievable if you focus on certain foods that are very rich in these important nutrients.
Yes, and you did a good job of that. And I agree
Thank you.
That in everyday life, we don't have to worry about these numbers. You just have to read this book and know that you're doing the right thing and then move on.
Awesome. Sounds good.
That's good. Okay. You know, so I mentioned that I was on an all raw diet around 2004, 2006. In hindsight, I probably wasn't doing it the best possible way. And there was a lot of trendy stuff going on. I'm not quite in that scene anymore, so I don't have my button on all the trends. But I remember going into the gourmet raw food restaurants and coming out not feeling very good. And how so many of the recipes were so filled with olive oil and salt in the form of namashoyu and loads of nuts, so heavy. Oh, yeah. Yes. And I'm happy to see that your book is not promoting that sort of raw diet.
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because that's kind of the same situation that my husband and I have when we go to those types of restaurants. Lots of oil, lots of nuts. It just feels very heavy. And so really with this book, I wanted to point out that when we're focusing on water-rich, whole natural plant foods, that's going to help with our digestion. It's going to help, you know, things move through our system better. It's going to give us the nutrients that we need without that kind of heavy, bogged-down feeling. Because one of the reasons why people actually do raw food is because they want to feel lighter. They want to feel, you know, more alive. They want to, you know, get more out of themselves. And if you're eating those really heavy, oily, nut-based types of recipes, you're not really experiencing that health. And I think that's one of the reasons why some people leave raw food, is they just don't feel well. And whereas if they just kind of shifted their diet a little bit to focus on kind of the lighter raw foods, mm-hmm. that are, interestingly enough, you know, even more nutrient dense than the more heavier oil types of things, you know, like fruits and vegetables, then you're going to get that feeling that you came into raw food for in the first place. So that's a lot of what we focus on in this book, and we also talk about this in our classes, because we really want people to succeed with this, because it's very doable, and it can make a big difference for a lot of people. We've seen it ourselves, including within ourselves.
I think some of it has to do with wanting to make foods that are similar to what we've been used to. And this is true in a vegan diet. This is true in a cooked raw mix vegan diet, where there are all of these meat analogs out there, veggie dogs and deli slices and all things that simulate meat. And in raw food restaurants, I've had the loaves and the different kinds of dehydrated things to make crackers and cups and things for desserts. And when we try and duplicate those foods that weren't healthy, they may be healthier than the original version, but they're still not the healthiest foods.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. And when I first got into veganism, you know, 26 years ago, I noticed that. I was thinking, well, geez, you know, I'm looking for health here, and by eating this meat analog type of thing here, I'm not really feeling that much better than mm-hmm. a so-called standard Western diet. And I think that these types of foods that sort of mimic our old-time favorites from our previous standard Western diet are very helpful for transition. But at some point, you need to transition out of those, or not necessarily need to, but, you know, hopefully at some point you move on from those and find new recipes to kind of replace your old-time favorites. And I think that, at least in the raw food movement in the past 25 years, we've seen kind of new standards. Like, okay, you come off of a standard Western diet onto a vegan diet and then to a raw food diet. So maybe you're into the raw lasagna for a while because it reminds you of what you ate when you were a kid, you know, or what have you. But then, you know, maybe over time a large, I wouldn't not necessarily say salad, but a big bowl of vegetables with some great dressing on it can replace that. Or maybe a green smoothie or, you know, some type of juice. There's just so many options out there these days that we don't necessarily have to rely on foods that resemble the ones that we used to like. I mean, those foods are great because they kind of remind us of our childhood, and there's something really wonderful about that.
Yeah.
But at least I can say from my point of view, my transition continued, I would say. and it's constantly changing. So I encourage people to really just, you know, look for recipes that really resonate with you and keep, you know, changing, experimenting, and find a mix that works well.
Okay, another thing that you cover in this book, and I was really happy to see it because I don't see the discussion very often, is you talk about enzymes, what they are, digestive, metabolic, food enzymes. Enzymes are one of those conversations that I remember having with people in the raw food movement that would cause some eye rolling with people who had a scientific bent.
Yeah. And I think I'm probably one of those people.
So can you give us a little clarity on, like, digestive enzymes? Do we need to get them from plants, and or do we need to supplement them, and what do they do? And
well, first of all, this is a great question, and I figured it was going to come up in this interview because almost every single time that I talk to people about raw food, the whole enzyme question comes up. And as far as enzymes go, I do cover it in the book. And it's my personal opinion, and, you know, based on my research and based on my own personal experience and the experience of others, that this whole idea of enzymes being the reason why we should consume raw foods, you know, have it being the primary reason why we should consume raw foods, I don't think it's the strongest argument for that. And the reason why is because the enzymes that we find in plant foods are the same or similar to the ones that we use in our digestive tract. But the difference is the enzymes in plant foods are not as active as our digestive enzymes. They just aren't. They can, to some small degree, contribute to our digestion, but not to the degree that people tend to think that they do. And so my thought is, if we're eating our foods raw and there are some plant enzymes in there, they can only help with digestion, but they certainly don't replace our digestive enzymes. You know, they don't do that. But, you know, I think there's so many other reasons why we should consume foods in their natural, raw state. A good example is phytonutrients and antioxidants. A lot of those can be inactivated with cooking. Certain types of vitamins can be inactivated with cooking. And raw foods, in general, are more water-rich than their cooked counterparts. And raw foods tend to be less calorie-dense and more nutrient-dense than their cooked counterparts. And then with raw foods, we don't have the formation of so-called novel substances. In the scientific literature, they refer to these things as cooked food toxins. So things like acrylamide, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, nitrosamines, heterocyclic amines, those things all tend to form with high heating methods. The threshold temperature for the formation of cooked food toxins is 248 degrees Fahrenheit. That is the threshold temperature for the formation of acrylamide. But so any cooking method that is under that temperature, we don't have the formation of novel substances. So things like cooking methods, for example, like steaming and boiling, will not form cooked food toxins.
Yeah, and cooking with oil, which enables you to get higher heats, can start making that more dangerous.
Absolutely, especially if you are leaning over a frying pan and the fumes, if you inhale those fumes, you're inhaling some of those problematic substances.
That's a good tip. Okay, don't cook with oil, so if you are, don't lean over and breathe it.
Yes.
Wow, you know, it's
so you don't want to eat it, you don't want to breathe it.
right, that's a really good one. All right, a couple more things. Water, you mentioned this a few times. I know a lot of people you hear from time to time, they get taken to the ER, especially elder people, and they're dehydrated. Wow. We have serious issue with hydration, although I recently read somewhere that said we don't need to have 8 glasses of water a day, and there's all kinds of things where people are continually telling us we have to be careful, we have to be hydrated, and that's because the foods that people eat today don't have water in them. And
that
you did a really good job in your book showing how plant foods provide gallons and gallons, it seems like, of water.
It's kind of astounding. When I was doing kind of the legwork for this chapter, I was just astounded. And when I was looking at what the recommendations are from the Institute of Medicine for water, I was thinking, wow, if you're eating a really high water content diet, how much extra water do you even have to consume?
Mm-mm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
our water intake should be dictated on how active we are, because we have a tendency to perspire, and water leaves our body through that. And, you know, sometimes some of us have a tendency to lose more water through transpiration than other people do. And so our need for water is very individual, definitely. But I guess my point that I was trying to make here in the chapter is that we can get most of the water that we need just from whole natural plant foods if we're eating them in their raw form. So we don't necessarily need to drink 8 glasses of water on top of that. That's really superfluous.
Right.
And if we're eating a cooked food-based diet, for example, like a standard Western diet, we're going to need to drink a lot of water to make up for what we're not getting from our food.
It makes a lot of sense. I find I don't really drink a lot of water. I happen to like tea, so I'll have a cup of tea from time to time. And I do green juice. I have my green juices every day. But
All right.
Other than that, if I'm thirsty, then I'll drink. It's kind of – and sometimes I think that having an orange, a juicy fruit, will feel better than actually – having a drink of water.
That makes sense, because if you're eating a food, you get, in addition to that water, a lot of important nutrients and all that fiber. In a lot of ways, that can be more satisfying, and I've noticed that myself, too.
Yeah. Okay, we just have like a couple minutes left, and I have too many things to ask you, but very quickly, you don't mention mushrooms in this book. Is there a reason for that?
Well, you know, the original manuscript for this book was about 500 pages long.
Mm-hmm,
and there was
I
a lot of things that I had to edit out. My publisher was like, oh, this is all great information, Karen, but you can't write a textbook here. No, they thought that would be too long. So there were a lot of things I had to cut out. And as far as mushrooms go, I think they can be very useful for some people depending on what they are. You know, there's a lot of kind of press that medicinal mushrooms have been getting
mm-hmm.
recently. And some of them are pretty amazing, and I'm thinking maybe in future books I will include information about them. But, you know, like other foods, not all mushrooms are created equal. Some of them can be quite medicinal, and other ones might not be so good. So we need to, you know, do our homework on them and, you know, see if they work out for us.
Okay, we have like about a minute and a half left, and
okay.
I guess, what are your favorite, most delicious foods to eat?
Wow. I guess my diet being pretty simple, I'd say fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds. My very favorite vegetable, interestingly enough, is dandelion greens. And I know that's really surprising for some people because, you know, it's like the most bitter thing on the entire planet. Well, I'm totally exaggerating. But I tend to like foods that are kind of astringent or bitter, whereas some people really like sweet fruit foods, or they like foods that have other types of qualities to them. Some people like salty tasting foods, but I don't know. I'm really into bitter stuff.
No, I get that. I love arugula.
Arugula is great.
Yeah, that musty.
Arugula kind of reminds me a little bit of like, what do you call it? Peanuts. Kind of has like a peanutty taste to it. And I love to put it in a green smoothie with some berries, because it kind of very slightly reminds me of like peanut butter and jelly. I have no idea why, but I love
that. Oh, I've got to do that. Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining me and giving me a little extra time. I really enjoyed reading this book, Raw Food Nutrition Handbook, An Essential Guide to Understanding Raw Food Diets. It's excellent, and you've got to get the rest of those pages that you didn't include in your book into a second part two.
That will be coming up probably in the next few years. And thank you so much for having me on the show, Karen.
Okay, thank you, and take care. You okay, too. We've come to the end. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. I was speaking with Karen Dina, the author of co-author of the Raw Food Nutrition Handbook. And visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. You could find out more about my guests today and get a lot of great recipes and a lot more. So, in the meantime, have a delicious week.